You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program, and I have the distinct pleasure and honor today of introducing Dr. Mark Esper, the 23rd Secretary of the Army, who has just completed his six-month mark, and with a fair amount on the agenda and a fair amount in play, and we're going to hear about a lot of it today. One of the things that Secretary Esper has been focused on, as many of you know, is Futures Command, the idea of streamlining and promoting Army innovation and modernization at a crucial time in support of the National Defense Strategy, in support of many other concerns of the armed forces around the world. But he's got to do that. At the same time, we're worried about Korea. At the same time, we're worried about readiness. At the same time, he's got to worry about the 1.4 million people who work for him in the active and reserve and National Guard and civilian workforce. And so it's a big agenda. Dr. Esper comes from Pittsburgh. I understand he may have just recently got a chance to meet Terry Bradshaw, which I'm sure was as much a thrill for the one as for the other, or it certainly should have been if Terry Bradshaw knows his military affairs as well as Secretary Esper probably knows his NFL. He went to West Point. He and Secretary Pompeo have now developed a little bit of a potential counterweight to the Marine domination of Washington that we even feel at Brookings with John Allen, our president. So the class of 86 from West Point is doing well in this administration. Dr. Esper was then a soldier and ranger and fought in Desert Storm, stayed in the Army for a while, was part of both the Reserve and the National Guard through his career, which he retired from the Army about a dozen years ago, or 11 years ago, I think. He's also had a diverse array of experiences on Capitol Hill, where he worked for Senator Frist and Senator Hagel, as well as having worked on both the House and Senate sides and both armed services and foreign relations. After all of that, he spent a lot of time working industry, so he really knows the full range of players who are crucial to this defense enterprise. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Secretary Esper to Brookings.
Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate that warm introduction. We've known each other for some time, so it's always good to see you. And yes, it's true, I'm from Pittsburgh. And that's important because, if any of you know, that the chief of staff and the vice chief of staff are both from Boston. So we have this argument all the time over Steelers versus Patriots. So I think I still have the upper hand because the Steelers have won 6 Super Bowls to the Patriots 5. So that should be on the record and make sure that's played back to General Milley when we get back to the office. But again, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about the Army's role in supporting the National Defense Strategy, to speak to you about the Army vision that we will be rolling out here in the next day or so, and talk about some of the objectives as we look forward. And then, of course, we'll have a conversation afterwards to get into some of the details. I want to pause right now, though, because I'd be remiss if I didn't. Today is June 5th. And if you were to go back 74 years in time, you'd realize right now in the UK, it's about 6 p.m. or so, a little bit after 6. You know, what would eventually be over 5,300 ships and 11,000 planes were conducting final preparations for the assault across the English Channel. Paratroopers from multiple divisions, the 101st and the 82nd, two of which I served in, were in their assembly areas, would probably be rigging up for the jump of their life, maybe the last jump of their life, in a few short hours as part of the beginning of Operation Overlord. Soldiers from the UK, US, and Canada would be boarding their ships. They would be assembling south of the island and preparing to cross the channel once the word was given. Minesweepers getting assembled as well to clear shipping lanes. Thousands and thousands of bombers preparing for the preparation of the final assault. And at midnight, those airborne soldiers would launch in 1,200 aircraft, and they would drop behind enemy lines. And the story after that is written in blood from the landing zones, from the assault beaches, Bloody Omaha, and it was an operation unlike ever in military history. And it's something to reflect upon in these hours before what would be, again, the Great Invasion, to think about that. And I think about that in context of my role as Secretary as we prepare for future wars, future conflicts. Those soldiers, those paratroopers who took part in Operation Overlord, were able to break open Fortress Europe because they were ready, they were prepared, they were lethal. They were fully manned as part of the largest army the nation had ever assembled. They were organized into lethal combined arms teams with access to indirect fires, air support, and naval gunfire, what today we would call multi-domain operations. They were trained and hardened, but through intensive preparation in the United States and England, as well as in the fires of conflict against Axis forces in Africa and Italy, they did not come ready to those conflicts. We learned some hard lessons early in the war, as we've done in some other wars as well. They are equipped by a fully mobilized private sector that we call the Arsenal of Democracy, and they were led by some of the finest leaders who have ever worn an American uniform, the likes of Eisenhower, Bradley, Ridgway, Taylor. Together with Allied forces, they triumphed in one of America's most daring and grueling campaigns ever fought. And although we prevailed in this conflict, the force assembled in England 74 years ago took 3 years to properly man, train, equip for this operation. George C. Marshall once said that the only way human beings can win a war is to prevent it. Now, he and I are from the same hometown, so I'll take a little liberty and say that on his words and say that the best way to prevent a war is to be prepared to win it. As outlined in the 2018 National Defense Strategy revised earlier this year, we are at an inflection point and have re-entered an era of great power competition. Now, while the nature of war has changed, the character of war has changed significantly. Evolving challenges, primarily from Russia and China, mark the return of great power competition, creating a future battlefield characterized by a few things: increased speed and lethality, constant surveillance, increasingly dense urban terrain, denied access to the theater, disrupted communications and electronics, and threats in all domains: air, land, sea, space, cyberspace. Despite this changing character of war, the Army's mission remains as constant as it was on D-Day: to deploy, fight, and win our nation's wars. The Army has aligned our strategic approach to support the NDS, which mandates that we build a more lethal and ready force. To this end, General Milley and I have developed the following Army vision, which we are officially rolling out tomorrow. Quote, "The Army of 2028 will be ready to deploy, fight, and win decisively against any adversary, anytime, and anywhere in a joint, multi-domain, high-intensity conflict, while simultaneously deterring others and maintaining its ability to conduct irregular warfare. Further, the Army will do this through the employment of modern manned and unmanned ground combat systems, aircraft, sustainment systems, and weapons, coupled with robust combined arms formations and tactics based on a modern warfighting doctrine and centered on exceptional leaders and soldiers of unmatched lethality." To achieve this vision in support of the NDS, I've identified five objectives. They are man, organize, train, equip, and lead, consistent with my Title 10 responsibilities. And similar to a transmission that synchronizes inputs through gears, producing a stronger output, these objectives will be achieved by, with, and through a new doctrine based on multi-domain operations. So first, let's talk about manning the force. We must sufficiently man the force, the Army of 2028. We must grow the regular Army above 500,000 soldiers with associated growth in the Guard and Reserve, and we must recruit and retain the very best. We have already begun to make progress in this effort. We are working to grow the force by 7,600 this year and 4,000 next year. We are exceeding our retention objectives. We are increasing deployability across the Army, and we are raising recruiting standards. Second, we must be organized to face high-end threats with capability and capacity. The NDS directs us to field, quote, "sufficient capable forces to defeat enemies and achieve sustainable outcomes," unquote. To achieve this, we must ensure adequate quantities of infantry, armor, engineers, air defense, field artillery, and make sure they exist to provide organic capability in each of our warfighting echelons. Our units from brigade through corps must also be able to conduct sustained ground and air intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, electronic warfare, and cyber operations. And we must have aviation, combat support, and robust logistics available to all formations. Two organizational changes you're seeing today are the establishment of Security Force Assistant Brigades to help build readiness, and Army Futures Command to bring unity of effort and unity of command to modernization. We're also exploring ways to push additional warfighting capabilities down to lower echelon tactical units, including medium-range, short-range air defense, MLRS, and other capabilities, such as engineer bridging. My third objective is focused on training. It must be tough, realistic, and dynamic, and it must be frequent, with sufficient repetition to ensure that the Army of 2028 will be ready for the battlefield of the future. Our training must be focused on high-intensity conflict, again, in urban terrain, under persistent surveillance, and in electronically degraded environments. It must incorporate battlefield innovation and continuous movement to frustrate enemy observation and intelligence collection. And it must include combined arms maneuver with the joint force, as well as our allies and partners. To achieve this, we are making changes to infantry basic training by extending the duration of the training to increase individual soldier lethality, to improve discipline, to improve fitness, and to do all these things to meet the demands of a high-intensity battlefield. I've also initiated an Army-wide review of training requirements, eliminating those that consume time without a commensurate benefit in increased lethality. And we are pulling those obligations, those requirements, off of our units' backs on a weekly basis. Fourth, to face the battlefield of the future, we must modernize our equipment. We've identified six modernization priorities. I'm sure you've heard of them. They are in order: first, long-range precision fires, next-generation combat vehicles, future vertical lift, the network, air and missile defense, and the one closest to my heart, soldier lethality. And fifth, lead. A modern Army manned with exceptional soldiers operating technologically superior equipment is only effective when properly led. In order to attract and retain the top talent necessary for meeting future threats, we must reform our outdated personnel system to one that develops smart, thoughtful, innovative leaders of character who are comfortable with complexity and are capable of operating from the tactical up to the strategic level. These objectives of man, organize, train, equip, and lead, synchronized through multi-domain operations doctrine, are the desired ends that align the Army's strategic approach with the National Defense Strategy and with what the Department of Defense calls for more broadly. As such, the Army's strategy will execute the NDS over the next decade in a series of time horizons, each associated with a future year's defense plan. Our top priority through 2022 is prioritizing preparedness for war by rebuilding warfighting readiness to compete, deter, and, if necessary, fight tonight and win against near-peer competitors. While we focus on rebuilding readiness, we will prioritize research and development on our six modernization priorities. This will enable us to transition technologies to systems for procurement when our priority shifts to modernization in 2023. Taken together, these objectives will place the Army on a path of irreversible momentum, ensuring we remain the preeminent land power depicted in the NDS and the Army vision. Our objectives directly support the tenets of the NDS strategic approach, creating a more lethal, ready, and modern Army as part of the joint force. In closing, this is an exciting time, as I believe we are at a critical junction in our nation's and our Army's history, where we must adapt to stay ahead of our adversaries. The success of Operation Overlord was due in large part to the buildup and readiness that occurred during the early years of World War II. The North Africa and Sicily campaigns, as I already referenced, tested our formations and provided critical lessons for airborne operations and amphibious landings against a capable and well-entrenched enemy. Intensive training in the United States in combined arms tactics, as well as thorough rehearsals in England prior to the launch of Operation Overlord, ensured our soldiers were ready for the difficult fight. Building sufficient readiness for a successful invasion of Normandy took 3 years. 3 years. We will not have that luxury in the next war. Should deterrence fail, the Army will need to immediately take the offensive to seize the initiative from our enemy. Stationary forces with obsolete equipment and unreliable communications are a liability on tomorrow's battlefield. We are fully aware of how other nations have adapted, changing the character of future warfare. We must respond in kind and better to remain the preeminent Army in the world. This will require time, resources, and leadership. Success in the next war will depend on how well we prepare today. The vision we have developed for the Army of 2028 will ensure that we maintain a ready, lethal force prepared to defeat any adversary, anytime, anywhere. So with that, I thank you for your time and look forward to our conversation today. Thank you, Michael.
Okay. Secretary Esper, thank you. That was terrific, and I really enjoyed the historical reference as well, and it reminds you what it's all about. I wanted to walk through some of the topics that you mentioned, maybe starting with people and readiness, and then getting to your modernization agenda, which I know is a big part of of what you're about, and then we'll look forward to Q&A with the audience as well. You mentioned that retention's been going pretty well. Mm-hmm. Could you give us a little fuller picture of the sum total of recruiting and retention? This is obviously a time when a lot of the press is full of specific discussions of gaps in capabilities with pilots, et cetera, in some of the other services at least, and maybe in the Army as well. I wondered if you could tell us about the overall health of the recruiting, retention, sort of in broader personnel of the force situation today.
Sure. Well, you start with retention, so I'll pick up there. We are seeing the highest retention numbers we've ever seen in a number of years. So that's a positive. That tells us that soldiers are happy with the career, they're satisfied with the profession, and they are enlisting, re-enlisting at higher rates. Now, that's a good thing, but the downside, of course, is it impacts the ability of the Guard and Reserve to roll those soldiers into their ranks, and that has a challenge there. On the broader front, though, it is a difficult environment. Thank goodness we have one of the best economies we've had in years. I think the unemployment rate, 3.8%, is the lowest it's been since the 60s or something like that. So that makes it challenging for all the military services to recruit. And again, I wouldn't necessarily trade that off for a strong economy. A strong economy is essential to everything else we need to do. But it does make for a challenging environment. We have aggressive goals this year. The goals we originally set out at the beginning of the year before the final NDAA was passed had us, I think, at 80,000. But then when the final numbers came through and the approved end strength, obviously we cannot break the legal cap, so we had to reduce that number down. And right now we're at, I think, 76,500. So we're coming now out what we typically call the bathtub of recruiting because once kids start graduating from high school and all that, that's where you start seeing the numbers really pick up. So we won't have a good idea where we stand until September or so, but we're pushing hard. And the one thing we do know is we need to grow the Army because of the challenges we face ahead, and we need to grow it with quality recruits. And so, as I said in my formal remarks, we are doing a number of things. I am to tune that up to make sure we raise standards. Earlier this year, I raised the bar on Cat 4 soldiers, so the DoD standard is no more from 4%. I cut that in half and said we're going to accept no more than 2% of Cat 4. So there are other things we're doing as well that will come out in due course. But overall, we're seeing good retention. We're seeing a challenging recruiting environment, but still seem to be on path to have good numbers by the end of the year. And we want to see continued end strength growth year over year over year until we breach that 500,000, have a better idea of our end state, and then can really focus in on the specific number and types of formations we're looking for.
And you came down to 76,500 or so because of legal mandates, not because of the recruiting environment per se.
No, that's right. So we originally started off with 80,000 because I think the Senate had a high mark of 10 and the House had a low mark of 5. I may have it the other way around, but they eventually compromised on 7,500. So that meant I had to reduce by 2,500 my number. So that brought us down to 77,500. And then retention bought us another 1,000, so that brought us down to 76,500 as of a few weeks ago.
One more question on this subject on the quality of the force.
There's been some reporting that we've lowered our number because we can't meet that. That's not accurate.
You mentioned quality, and I realize this is potentially, maybe not today, but potentially a delicate subject because you're the Secretary of the Army, you're the leader of the Army, and so obviously you're grateful for the quality of the personnel working for you, but you also have to keep an eye on the new recruits and whether they're meeting standards that you would like to set. How would you describe, having mentioned the Category 4 issue already, how would you describe the quality of today's recruits compared to, let's say, when you were in the Army, you know, that sort of golden period of the immediate post-Reagan buildup? The late 80s, early 90s. Compare that to today. How do we look?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Each generation is different, and so each generation brings in certain strengths that maybe others before them or after them didn't have. So this generation has an incredible facility with electronics, with software, and all that. Certainly, my generation didn't have, and so you see that. But maybe. So you've got to figure out how do you adapt and work with that. On the other hand, they may not be coming in as physically fit as previous generations for one reason or another. So that's one reason why we're looking at an extended basic training that takes us out to at least 21 weeks, and
a new physical fitness test, all these things, not just for that generation, but overall to improve the fitness of the Army and to improve the readiness and lethality of the total force at the end of the day.
So thinking of readiness now leads naturally to the discussion of both training and then equipment maintenance, two other key pillars in the overall readiness and, you know, being able to fight tomorrow or fight tonight, as they say in Korea, where I just visited at General Brooks' invitation a couple of weeks ago. How would you describe our state today of training, which I know for much of the 21st century has been focused too much, or at least, you know, asymmetrically and almost obsessively on the fights of the Middle East, and you and Secretary Mattis and others have been trying to change that. How far have we come towards building a full-spectrum force, the kind that H.R. McMaster wrote about when he was at Army Futures Command, or excuse me, Army Training and Doctrine Command, back, you know, before all the White House period, and when your predecessors produced the Army operating concept. How far have we come now towards restoring our force to a full-spectrum fighting capability?
Sure. Well, it's worth going back in time to, you know, post 9/11. And then, of course, when that happened, and then the invasion of Iraq in 03, what we did was we focused nearly entirely on low-intensity conflict. And not only did we do that, we also told some units to leave your howitzers and cannons in the motor pool or leave your tanks in the motor pool. And we focused the entire force on those types of operations with all formations fully in. And so now after 17 years, we've in the last couple years now, and under the leadership of General Milley, when he came in, is to reorient the force back on high-intensity conflict. And the National Defense Strategy tells us to go that same direction as well, given the era of great power competition. So one of my first trip as Secretary, I went to the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, and I was pleasantly surprised by what I saw. It was the 1st Cavalry Division out there fighting a high-intensity conflict against all the threats you would expect to see on that type of battlefield, and they were doing so against the types of operations that the Russians presented to the Ukrainians in the Donbass. And so they were dealing with drones, they were dealing with intermittent communications, they were dealing with cyber attacks, and that really, you know, gave me a good feel that we were on the right path. It was reminiscent of when I was a platoon leader in 101st, I trained at the NTC, the same things we did then. It's the high-intensity fight, that type of focus. By the same token, it's also great to see that the heavy forces are back out in the field training. Abrams, Bradleys, the field artillery men are out there using their equipment. And it seems counterintuitive, but a good indicator is that we're seeing more repair parts and more maintenance required because we are using the vehicles again at the pace we need to. And those are all good indicators that we are on the right path, we are focused on the right things. The difference this time around as compared to coming out of Vietnam in 73, 74, 75 is we cannot afford to say goodbye to low-intensity conflict. It will be with us for many years to come, unfortunately. So that's why built into the Army vision, built into the National Defense Strategy, is the imperative that we maintain a competency in irregular warfare. And so the challenge that we will have, that this generation will have, that my generation did not have, is being able to certainly be prepared to deploy, fight, and win that high-intensity conflict, but also have the skills, the competency, the equipment you need to conduct your regular warfare.
As you continue this effort at high-end training, and like you said, General Milley's been doing it now for a while, and arguably it began towards the midpoint of the decade and is maybe picked up now with the Trump administration, do you have the sense that we're halfway back to where we need to be, three-fourths of the way back? I mean, when I look at the numbers in the Army budget, it seems like you've been funding for the last 3 or 4 years, roughly 20 rotations by different brigades in the National Guard and the active Army per year, which suggests that even though you can never fully catch up with all the training cycles that were missed before when people didn't get to train at different ranks and so forth, nonetheless, most units should have by now in the last 3 years gotten back to the NTC with a higher end training. Not all of it's been in your tenure, not all of it's been in the Trump administration, but it looks like we're hopefully more than halfway back to recovery. Is that a good way to think about it?
I think about it this way. We've seen a good readiness pickup in the last year and a half. We had a nice down payment from Congress with the FY17 funding. FY18 was fantastic numbers, and FY19, if the budget agreement holds, will serve us well also. So it puts us on a great trajectory. We've seen big increases in our readiness, certainly in the regular Army, but also in the Guard and Reserve as well. We believe that if funding remains constant and the demand remains unchanged, that by 2022 we will be at that level of readiness we need to meet and maintain. That's why in my remarks, what I said is come the 2022-2023 timeframe, you will see in our budgets, in our emphasis, a lot more now at that point of harvesting what we've done in terms of research, development, prototyping, et cetera, to put that into modernization and really begin procuring the types of equipment we need associated with those big six priorities. I'd be remiss if I didn't say as well, we're doing a lot to lift off, as I mentioned in my remarks, a lot more home station training by lifting off the backs of our junior leaders, off of our units, a lot of this what's called mandatory training, things like that, that consumes their training availability, their time at home station. So all these things together, if everything remains constant, and things rarely do, will put us in a good position in the 22 timeframe.
Is there any one of those six priorities? You mentioned that the lethality of the warfighter is nearest and dearest to your heart, but is there any one of the six where you feel like we have a particular vulnerability now? So that sort of talking about 2022, 2023, well, I understand what you're getting at. It's almost too long to wait for some of the actions we need to take in the shorter term.
Well, we prioritized, and that's why long-range precision fires is number one for the Army. We think that for a number of reasons, we need to make sure we have overmatch in indirect fires, not least for, you know, a ground campaign, but also we need to have the ability to support our sister services. So if I need to, for example, suppress enemy air defenses using long-range artillery, I have the means to do that reaching deep into the enemy's rear. What that does, if I can suppress enemy air defenses, either the guns, missiles, radars, etc., it helps clear the way for the Air Force to do what they do and what they do well. The same is true if I'm supporting our Navy colleagues in terms of cross-domain fires. If we're at a coastline, we can help, again, using long-range, I'm talking multi-hundred-mile range, rockets, artilleries, etc., to help suppress them, to open up the door, if you will, so that the Navy can, again, gain access to a certain theater. And this is something that Secretary Spencer, Secretary Wilson, and I talk about when we meet pretty regularly. How do we work with one another? How does each service support one another in the warfight we see ahead? So long-range precision fire is number one.
And the network is four. Some people are worried that our networks today are particularly fragile because of cyber vulnerabilities and electronic warfare vulnerabilities. I know you're concerned about that too, but when you put that number four, is that to indicate that you have at least some reasonable confidence that it's not going to fall apart tomorrow in a high-end fight, that it's certainly going to be tested, it's going to experience strain, but you don't see this as an emergency per se. Is that a fair conclusion?
It's four, but it's the network underlies everything. If you look at long-range precision fires, I need a network. If you look at future vertical lift, I need a network. If you look at air and missile defense, I need a network. So the network's critical to all of them. I think we have capability now, but the biggest concern coming out of, again, what we saw in Ukraine, what various studies have said is that the network we have now that served us extremely well in Iraq and Afghanistan is too immobile. There is fragility in it. It's not reliable. The signals it emits makes us vulnerable. So that's why in terms of the network we've talked about halting, fixing, and pivoting. So we're now in the fix and pivot part of this, where we're looking at a very robust commercial approach to procuring what we need to build and maintain the network going ahead. And so we'll see technology turning over a lot more frequently, I think, in the years ahead with regard to the network.
As we talk a little bit more about modernization, and then I'll wrap up and let other people share in the fun here, this is really a great, fun conversation for me, so thank you. But I wanted to ask about the National Defense Strategy and how to understand that in the context of where we are today in 2018, because Chairman Dunford talked about a 4+1 threat environment, Russia, China, but also North Korea, Iran, and then transnational violent extremism. And I guess they've started talking about that as 2+3 instead of 4+1 to make it more consistent with the National Defense Strategy and the emphasis on China and Russia. But now we know that Secretary Mattis is prioritizing peer-to-peer competition. Mm-hmm. And yet you've got to prepare an army for possible conflict in Korea and ongoing conflict in much of the broader Middle East. And I guess I'm still struggling with how to understand the National Defense Strategy in that context and how to understand the fact that it wants to prioritize on two main focal points, whereas most other things that are being done today in the National Military Strategy has a broader range of threats and concerns. Is there a contradiction, or is it more that Secretary Mattis, who's aware of all these competing concerns and immediate threats, wants to use the NDS to remind us to keep thinking long-term, even as we do everything else that's sort of in the inbox today?
Well, you keep in mind the NDS is only a few months old at this point. There's going to be a period of transition where we're all pivoting, or we're making turns in that direction. We're adjusting. The Army, I think we've been ahead of the curve. I can't speak for the other services, but even now, as we build our POM for 20 to 24, making a lot of changes there to make sure that we pivot to where the NDS points us and tells us to do. That said, I think it's, my logic is you prepare for the toughest fight, and that's what I think the SecDef is telling us. Prepare for the toughest fight, and I expect we'll be able to handle the others. So the historical example that comes to mind is my war, Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm. I mean, the army that we built in the 80s was geared to fight the Soviets in the Fulda Gap in Germany. And so what happened is the wall fell, Soviet Union fell apart, and then up comes Iraq in August of 1990, and they just happened to be the unfortunate benefactors of this great military we built in the 1980s. And so that army, that military, Navy, Air Force, is the one that defeated the fourth largest army at the time in less than 100 hours. So clearly that force we built for the Soviet Union was able to handle a conflict presented by a regional power. That's how I approach it. If we can build the force, the vision of 2028, the Army of 2028, when we build that force consistent with the NDS, geared toward great power competition, Russia and China, I'm confident that we'll be able to handle any regional players as well with that construct.
I wanted to really just have two more questions. I wanted to invite you to just talk a little bit about Futures Command and how that fits into everything else you're talking about today, where we stand with that, what are the next milestones, what do you really hope to get out of that in the next couple of years?
It continues to be a work in progress, but we are making progress. We have identified a commander. We are continue to narrow the list of possible locations. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is how we will assemble the command, the fact that it brings, it takes this whole disparate modernization enterprise that is spread across the Army in different commands and brings it all under one roof, under a single commander. And at the same time, we're also adjusting processes. We're trying to cut down the layers of bureaucracy radically. So, for example, the cross-functional teams that have been stood up and operating now for several months have reduced the layers from, I think, 13 to 3. And we're seeing a lot more action, a lot more speed out of it. We're putting a much greater emphasis on prototyping and demonstrating. I'm putting more emphasis on, in terms of contracting, making sure that we go with best value rather than lowest price technically acceptable. So there are a number of things we're doing in addition to standing up the headquarters and deciding where to put it. And I think it's going to take time to deliver, but we're seeing some early results, some early successes already from what the cross-functional teams are doing. So I'm very encouraged by that.
So just one last question, and then open it up to others. As you do all this with Futures Command and pursue the National Defense Strategy, and you're trying to streamline, you're trying to reduce bureaucracy, speed things up in some cases, get Silicon Valley involved in some cases, really expedite Army modernization. I know hovering in the back of everyone's memory are the Army challenges of recent decades. And we can think of the Sergeant York and the Future Combat System and, artillery and helicopter designs that didn't work out. And I'm wondering how we reduce the odds of having that kind of a problem in the future, because going faster and streamlining, while it's certainly going to help for some problems, may not help avoid making such big mistakes. I mean, I'm not sure the reason why we had a future combat system that ultimately fell flat was because we went too slow. In some ways, it seemed like it was because we were trying to go too fast even then, and we just did it the wrong way. So how do we avoid those kind of problems in the future?
Well, there's a lot of ways to answer that. So, one is, as I came into this role, I said, well, we can continue to work within the current system, and we can tweak around the margins, and my guess is we'll probably end up with similar problems. And these have been cataloged over the years. There have been reports and panels and experts and hearings and whatnot. Or we can do something very different. There are some models out there. And we can make a bold move and try and change not just the process and the systems, but at the same time the culture. And that's what we're on to. That's the promise of Army Futures Command. And we went back to those basic principles that we learned growing up in the Army, the principles of war. And one is you have to have unity of command. You have to have unity of effort, which are things we did not have currently. Will we suffer big failures like we did in the past? I don't believe so, because we are willing to suffer little failures. And that is, the way we're approaching this now is let's work with industry, be more open, let them put their dollars on the table, we'll put some dollars, let's prototype, And if we're going to fail, let's fail early, let's fail cheap, and learn from that. And again, currently we have, for example, on Future Vertical Lift, we have two demonstrators out there. One's already flown, one will fly. We have some prototypes coming on board for next generation combat vehicle. And so it's that approach where we want to, there will be failure, but there will be smaller failures. And the other thing we got to be careful of is in the spirit of prototyping and innovating, we have to be willing as a leadership team, and certainly as we communicate to Congress and OSD, that there will be failures. We should not overreact. We should expect that, because there is a lot learned from failure. But the key is to learn those lessons and quickly pivot, go with the system you want, identify those requirements, and then move forward from there.
You made me think of one last question, so I'm going to cheat and add one more to my list. You had a distinguished career in industry as well, and a lot of the issues we're talking about now relate to industry, which ultimately is the provider of a lot of this technology, most of it. So I wondered if you had any specific concerns as Secretary of the Army about the state of the defense industrial base, anything we as a broader community need to keep our eye on in terms of thinking about that as an independent variable. Often it's the afterthought. How does the industrial base adjust to whatever budget or technology that the broader defense community has and the defense budget process has asked it to provide? But if we think of it as its own entity in its own right, as the arsenal of democracy of today, are there any parts of it today that really concern you, either because we're down to a sole provider or there are certain gaps in supply chains or anything else that's on your mind?
Well, you hit the nail on the head for me that first came to mind. That is, we have to preserve competition. And that means writ large at the macro, but when you get to a specific program, you have to preserve competition as far as you can into the program, because what that ends up getting you is a better price and higher quality. And certainly when you, again, step back at the broader industrial base, the more competition you have, the more innovation you get, again, you get better price, you get all those things. But that said, I think we also need to do more outreach, and I do it on a frequent basis, to a broader set of industry partners. So look at the non-defense sector. How do we involve them? Look at small business. They tend to be the real entrepreneurs, the real innovators. And we need to look abroad. I've said this several times, is we need to be willing to look at what our allies, our partners are producing. If it's a good system, we should buy it, or buy it and adapt it, whatever the case may be. And we're pushing across the table. And I will tell you, recently, the chief and I have talked about this, is we got to be willing to buy what our sister services are researching and developing as well. We can't afford to both be researching the same type of things. We need to work together. And that's where Secretary Wilson, Secretary Spencer, and I are really working hard to make sure we break down those barriers, wherever they exist, between our services, too.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. Let me now allow others to join in as well. So why don't we... when we start here in the front row, please wait for a microphone and identify yourself, if you could. And here it comes.
Megan Myers, Army Times. So you mentioned because retention is so good, you're having a harder time manning the Guard and the Reserve.
No, I didn't say that. I said it makes it more challenging for the Guard and Reserve to meet their numbers.
Potato, potato. So what is then the answer there? Is it bonuses for Guard and Reserve? Is it up to marketing to figure that out, or recruiters to steer more people toward?
Yeah, I think we have to look at all that. I think you have to look at bonuses in areas where you have particular challenges. There are other ways you can do it administratively. For example, maybe top choice on next assignment. There are a number of things that you can do, and the commanders have all those tools available to them to make sure that they can keep good soldiers on the team.
Please, right behind you. Yes, Sydney.
Hi. Sidney Friedberg, Breaking Defense. I want to pull in a thread here. One thing you've said, many times in the past is, we're concerned about the budget deal only going through 19. Sequester may return in 2020. We're going to, we're taking precautions against that even now. But today you also said we are going to build up the in strength to 500,000 active and beyond. Now, in strength is a huge bill for the Army, and it's a long-term bill. You don't just lay people off after the holiday season like Amazon. So how do you reconcile those two things? On the one hand, you have a long-term concern that you may go over a fiscal cliff. On the other hand, you are taking on a long-term expense of people, and you people are, the car of the Army. You can't treat them lightly.
Well, I didn't say that we're going off a fiscal cliff. What I said was I know that I have good numbers in 18. I think if the budget agreement holds, we'll have good numbers in 19. I cannot predict the future. And so what I want to do is gain as much control over the Army's destiny as I can. And that means a series of internal reforms by which I free up money to pay for my modernization efforts, to pay for extended basic training, to pay for end strength. So there are things in my control. There are things out of my control. What's in my control is to lay out a clear or as clear as possible vision of what the Army of 2028 should look like. And then it's up to me working with OSD and congressional partners and all that to help us fulfill that vision by providing the resources we need to get there.
Over here is Sandy. Keep working back.
Sandy Apgar, CSIS, former Assistant Secretary for INE. As you know, the Army pioneered program to privatize military housing, now throughout DOD, released roughly $30 billion of savings and countless innovations. Have you considered ways to adopt that model, which has been so successful, exceeded all of its goals in over a sustained 20-year period, to other non-core functions that represent heavy assets, high costs, and potentially low productivity in their current form?
You know, nothing specifically comes to mind when you ask that question, but I do think those are things we need to look at, are different approaches by which we leverage the private sector and what it brings, and look at those partnerships and focus first on our core business. I mean, again, in terms of modernization, that's where, as we look at the budget build, is how do we focus on those key priorities and look at other things that maybe can be offset in other ways. So it's a good idea. I'll welcome any ideas beyond that if you have it. But we're looking at things like that by which we can free up time, money, and manpower to really focus on what's the core of what the Army needs to do in a future war fight.
Here in the third row, please.
Hello, Kathleen Delano, CEO of PMIC, and mm-hmm. Nice to see you again, and thank you again for sharing. I was particularly excited to hear you mention research and development when you were talking about Futures Command, mm-hmm. and as an avid proponent of U.S. Army and, in general, U.S. government S&T, I'm wondering about your involvement with Army Research Lab and what some of the foundational labs may be doing to integrate and to bring that beginning of the supply chain, like mm-hmm. in industry terms, I guess we would say supply chain. Mm-hmm. I am an accidental GovCon who is translating the Army parlance, so mm-hmm. S&T is the beginning of the supply chain. Is that being factored into Futures Command, and how can we get that to happen?
Well, it absolutely is. It's being aligned up underneath Army Futures Command, and what that means is the Army Futures Command commander will have the ability, as he or she thinks about the material solutions we need in the future, to have some control, to have control over where we put our S&T dollars way at the front end, so that we get that product or prototypes, if you will, at the right point in time to help us make requirements decisions or procurement decisions. So that is absolutely critical. I will tell you that even for 18, we have realigned 80% of the S&T budget to line up with our priorities. So that's the other piece of that, is make sure that everything that our great researchers, our scientists, our engineers are focused on is focused on those six priorities, and we don't have stray electrons going out in other areas that are of lower priority.
Stay here in the second row with my friend, and then the first row after that, and then we'll start working back, I promise. I'll see you further in the room.
Sir, George Nicholson at Washington Liaison with the Global Special Operations Forces Foundation. Recently, General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, and General Dunford have directed that a range of options be presented of how you rebalance special operations, cut back what all our people are doing, to balance it with emerging threats and ongoing threats. How do you see, is there a dialogue going on with the Army of the kinds of things that we're having to do with soft catching ourselves coming and going, what the Army can do in the future to help alleviate that?
Yeah, I have not been involved in that, if that's happening. My focus is really on the conventional Army, but clearly, given the mission that we have to maintain competency in irregular warfare, the soft community will be critical. I think the Army Special Ops community provides the bulk of what SOCOM has, or at least the majority. So it's very important. We want to make sure we maintain that capability. But beyond that, that's all I have at this point.
By the way, just a clarification, if I could. we know that the Obama administration in its 2012 National Defense document and also in its 2014 QDR that your good friend Secretary Hagel presided over, at that time the Army was instructed not to size forces for large-scale stabilization operations any longer, but still to try to retain in parts of the Army some degree of the expertise and excellence so that it could be rejuvenated as necessary. Are you making a slightly stronger statement that under the Trump, Mattis, Esper National Defense Strategy and the Army's role within that, that you're actually going to prioritize retaining that competence and excellence a little more than latter year Obama documents would have had us do?
I'd have to see the documents. I don't want to characterize it one way or the other. I'd have to read it. But I'm just saying that what the National Defense Strategy tells us is to focus on the high-intensity conflict against these peer competitors, but maintain this irregular warfare capability, because we will continue to fight violent extremist organizations. We will have counterterrorism duties, responsibilities around the world for years to come, unfortunately. So we have to maintain that capability, certainly in the soft side. But there are also irregular warfare capabilities that we have to maintain in the conventional side, the ability to conduct low-intensity conflict, counterinsurgency. So I'll just characterize it that way.
Here in the front row, please.
Thanks. Courtney McBride with Janes. Secretary Esper, you mentioned the need for greater willingness to purchase the products of your sister services' mm-hmm. R&D efforts. Yesterday, Marine Corps leaders were at CSIS talking about their services' efforts to develop a sort of an interim solution for long-range precision fires, as they also have shortfalls mm-hmm. there, while they are sort of aligned with the Army on PRISM. Is there some risk of duplication of effort there as the services continue to develop their own solutions to a common problem?
Well, we talk a lot, particularly through the cross-functional teams on these top issues. So I know we're talking on long-range fires. I'd have to go back and find out what's going on. But clearly in those areas, we do not want to duplicate. I don't want to spend the time, money, or manpower to figure out what the Marines or the Air Force or the Navy has already figured out. We need to share. I know that type of sentiment is also shared by Secretary Spencer and Secretary Wilson. We just can't afford to do otherwise. So we're looking for any opportunities we can to work together or to, again, look at each other's technology. I experienced this the other day, last week or 2 weeks ago, when walking around in the Pentagon courtyard where we're looking at, for example, personal protective equipment, and the Marines are working on a product there. And you know, the chief and I had that same discussion. You know, what are the Marines developing? We should be looking at what they're doing and maybe, buying what they're buying or vice versa. So I know the Marines, for example, I think all the services are buying our new handgun. That's an example of where those types of things are happening. We need to do it on a much broader scale. And certainly we need to do it in R&D also.
Is there a formalized effort to do that on a broader
scale? I can't cite for you what the formalized effort is, but you know, culture is always stronger than agreements and formalization. So we're trying to build a culture of sharing amongst one another and generating each other and adopting each other's best ideas.
We go a little further back in the room. Let's see. There's a woman in about the seventh row over by the wall. Yes, please. Get her a microphone.
That was good.
I made up that number seven.
Yeah, just...
Hi, Ellen Milheiser from Synopsis Newsletter. Army medicine spends a lot of money on research, and they do most of the medical research of all the services, as you know. Do you see yourself taking any of their medical research money and putting it into modernization?
In all this, everything is on the table, but that's not something that kind of comes to mind right now. But I think, again, with medical research, it needs to be focused on where the NDS tells us to go, and that, you know, high-intensity conflict, the type of trauma we would see in that type of conflict, the needs of making sure that we can take care of soldiers in that golden hour, get them back to a hospital. I mean, that's kind of how I think about it. I want to make sure that we're focused along those lines. But Army medicine, I should say military medicine, to its credit, I think has led many innovations over the years just because of what we've had to adapt to and learn and help our soldiers and sailors, airmen, and Marines on the battlefield. So, anyways.
Stay in that general area. There's a gentleman a couple rows further back in a light shirt. Yes.
Thank you. Eric Rowe with the Asahi Shimbun. A few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to attend a panel that Deputy Director of the MDA Hill was at. And one of the discussions that they had is the kind of trade-off between missile defense coverage and cost. Is there a kind of consensus within the Army about what is the best strategy to address this, whether it be point defense or whether it be more coverage at more cost? And is there a consensus between the services as well? Thank you.
Well, certainly at the Army, we're looking at making sure we have the air and missile defense capabilities that we need for the future fight. So as I noted in my former remarks, one thing that we know we need, because we took it out of the formation years ago, was mobile short-range air defense. So we'll be having prototypes come out in the 2020 timeframe. We'll begin fielding them to see how they work. It'll be an interim solution. But we know, again, moving forward, we need to have that capability. We also need to have soldiers in our light formations who are able to carry, you know, handheld devices, man pads, if you will, to help defend against these threats. I mean, keep in mind, for the last 17 years, we have fought enemies who don't have air forces, and we won't see that in the future. The chief of staff likes to say that an American soldier hasn't been killed by enemy aircraft since, I think, the Korean War. So those things all are turned on their head when you think about a future, possible future conflict against a Russia or a China. So we need to be prepared to defend against that.
And standing in the back, one row further, please.
Hi, my name is Mike Slowinski from Avison. Thank you for coming to speak with us. In your modernization priorities, you didn't speak very much about robotics or automation. Could you speak about ways that UGVs and automation might impact any of the modernization priorities?
Yeah, actually, I think robotics has the potential of changing, fundamentally changing the character of warfare. And I think whoever gets there first will have a unique advantage on the modern battlefield. So as you see my vision, I mean, I call out pretty clearly in that second paragraph of the vision that we are going to move to a force that has unmanned vehicles. And that includes the technologies critical to that will be robotics and AI and a number of other things to make that happen. So I think who gets there first will have a distinct advantage. We're going to be putting money into those fields, and my ambition is by 2028 to begin fielding autonomous, certainly semi-autonomous vehicles that can fight on the battlefield, sustain us, provide those things we need, and then we'll continue to evolve from there.
I want to follow up on that if I could before going back to the audience, because we know that looming in the country, or maybe even underway already, is this concern about the long range of robotics and artificial intelligence. And of course, it's the Terminator vision that is in some ways on people's minds. It used to seem like just a complete science fiction fantasy concept back when the movies were first made. It doesn't seem so fantastical anymore. And I know Elon Musk has warned about how civilization itself could be imperiled. I know professors at the Ivy League, who talk about cyber as a WMD of the future. So this is going mainstream with some pretty impressive proponents that we have to be worried. I don't expect you to put all of our concerns to rest today.
Well, we're not building a T-3000 or whatever.
But not yet. But how do we think about, how do we even start to think about this, knowing that we're not going to solve it today, because we're only at the beginning of this technology and this revolution, but also being aware that there's no way to verify most of what's done with software. And so even if we were ourselves to impose restraints, it's hard to know what our adversaries would themselves restrain. How do we even begin a debate, or how does the Pentagon even set up future procedures for decision-making that would wrestle seriously with this question of how do we not let AI go out of control?
Well, those are serious questions. I think they need to be addressed, and the sooner we begin discussing them, the better. But in my view, my vision at least, there will be a soldier in the loop. There needs to be. The battlefield is too complex as is, so we'll need to have a soldier in the loop. In terms of, you know, the vision I've spoken about with regard to using robotics or, let's say, semi-autonomous vehicles on the battlefield, the comparison is what the Air Force uses with its drones, Predators, right? So if I could, so an unmanned drone with missiles is able to fly over an enemy battlefield and conduct missions and without the risk of losing airmen, then I want that same capability on the ground with a vehicle that I can. Again, I can operate semi-autonomously at some distance so the soldier's not vulnerable. But yet, because of that, I'm willing to take more risk, get closer into the fight, and engage an enemy, all with a soldier in a loop, working off of a screen, if you will, moving that tank, shooting that main gun, whatever the case may be. I want to get to that point. And I think at that point, you now see a system whereby Again, soldiers are at less risk, less vulnerable. You can take more risk. I can then start producing tanks that don't weigh 90 tons because I no longer have to protect the crew. It can be a less expensive tank. It could weigh less. That gives me strategic mobility in terms of moving these vehicles between theaters, and it gives me arguably some enhanced tactical mobility as well. So there are a number of advantages if we can get there, if we can make the autonomy work. But doing that on the battlefield is far different than doing it on the streets of Pittsburgh or wherever the case may be. So that's going to take a lot of effort.
Excellent. We'll stay a little bit further in the back, and then we'll come back for one more sweep to the front. There's a gentleman on the right side, my right, which I've been generally neglecting in some of this. So we'll start with him about 12 rows back on the aisle. Yes, you, sir. And then
pick the ones with the easy questions.
Exactly, yeah.
Galano Davis, part of the Brookings Executive Education. And I have a two-part question for you, sir. So it's going back to personnel readiness. In wake of the Supreme Court decision yesterday dealing with same-sex marriage, has those type of social issues impacted the readiness of our Army? And second part of the question is, what is your guiding star, senior leadership, when it comes to trying to make that transition or trying to keep the morale, keep the esprit de corps with our soldiers when it comes to barracks, when it comes to on-post housing, when it comes to benefits, when it comes to the training, combat arms?
I'm not sure I chose the guy with the easy question, but anyway, over to you.
Yeah. Wrong pick. What was his? Well, I didn't understand the second question, though. Can you?
Esprit de corps.
What is your guidance to our leadership or the Army leadership? Your guidance on how to deal with this transition socially, legally, etc.
Yeah, so to me, it's very simple. The Army is a standards-based organization. And so I think we need to maintain standards across the board with regard to deployability, with regard to readiness, with regard to lethality. I found, as I traveled the Army, soldiers want to be treated fairly, want to be treated equally, if you will. So I think to the degree we can maintain standards, maintain good order and discipline, maintain those things, I think it has served us well in the past and will serve us well in the future. My sense, what keeps soldiers happy or motivated or maintains esprit is pretty straightforward. They join the Army for a reason, and they want to live it. They want to actualize, if you will. So you'd be surprised the number of soldiers who tell me, I just want to train more. I want to deploy. I want to go abroad. I want to get in my tank. I want to shoot my howitzer. That's what they want. So I think that's why I've pushed hard, as the chief, to get soldiers out to the NTC, the JRTC, to deploy abroad to Europe as part of Atlantic Resolve or to Korea, or just simply get these mandatory training requirements off their backs so that when they're at Fort Campbell or Fort Bragg or you name it, they are actually training and not doing online, taking online courses or some type of other training that really is not what they signed up for or what they want to do. So to me, that's the key, one key. The other one is making sure that we return power to junior leaders, particularly NCOs, to lead their soldiers, to be responsible for them, and not just 9 to 5, 5 days a week, but 24/7, 365 days a year. That's where we're heading back to.
There was another hand here on that same side of the room. I see it's a gentleman maybe a row ahead of, yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Secretary, as you know, Amazon is looking at various places to relocate their second headquarters, including our hometown of Pittsburgh. And one of the reasons they're looking at cities is to maximize the impact of putting a new facility in a location that will just sort of have secondary benefits. When you think of locating the new home for the Army Futures Command, could you reveal some of the ideas that you look for as to the best location and how that can be a multiplier effect, not just for the Army, but for the region you choose? Thank you.
Sure. I suspect that the Army and the Amazon have different requirements and therefore different criteria. I will tell you that the reason why we are looking to go to a location, the locations we're looking at, and I've said this publicly in testimony, is we want to make sure that Army Futures Command can benefit from some of the best talent that is out there. So we want to go to a location that has innovators, has folks who are a lot of competency in the STEM fields, folks who we have that give us access to industry, or more importantly, academia, because the whole notion of Futures Command, at least the part of it, is to be able to envision the future and what that future may look like, but then think through what the material solutions, and then have at our fingertips access to those persons in those particular fields, scientists, engineers, theorists, whatever the case may be, have access to them to think about those things, to help us solve the problems, and in some cases maybe hire them into the command. You're not going to get that at a traditional troop post, if you will. So that's some of the key criteria we're looking at with regard to that. As we continue to narrow this down, different filters come into play. We want to make sure we, at the end of the day, we have good quality of life for whoever who mans Futures Command, military and civilian. But there, again, these things go through a number of filters. That what I just outlined with regard to access to talent, academia, those things were one of the key features that have necked us down to where we are today.
So we have time for a couple more questions. I think I'll go here in the front row, and then I'll go with a couple more to wrap up.
Thank you. This is a young reporter from Voice America. Mr. Secretary, you just mentioned that the modernization of the U.S. Army and U.S. military. And I read an article. It's two questions concerning China. China is also rapidly modernizing its army. And I read an article which says China just flight tests its new multi-warhead ICBM. So my question is, how many years the U.S. still ahead of China when it in terms of advanced weapon system? And the second question is about Senator Marco Rubio's comments. He said that the U.S. officials should plan to destroy the installation in the South China Sea. So my question is, do you share his view? Thank you.
Well, I'm going to stick to my lane, and my lane is Title 10, manning, training, equipping the force. I'll leave the questions with regard to war plans and what we can do and this we can do. I'll leave that to the combatant commanders and whatnot. So.
Okay, we'll go here in the second row, please.
Hi, Katie Holzman with the Chamber of Commerce. I think you're familiar. So my question is in regards to the new defense strategy. Do you think that taking a look at the MTCR guidelines and revisiting those to better equip our allies and partners is something that's feasible? And if so, do you have any recommendations or things that might work?
Take a look at, I'm sorry, which guidelines?
MTCR, the Missile Technology Control Regime.
That's not an issue that's on my radar screen right now. It's something I would kick up to OSD policy. They handle that. Having worked in OSD policy before, I'm familiar with those issues, but it's just not something that affects me, affects our modernization plan right now, where we sit and where we are.
Gentlemen here in the third row, please.
Is this a lightning round?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It feels that way.
Yeah, I'll keep it.
So, Sam Delano at the Osgood Center for International Studies, and I'm wondering, in regards to modernization and your efforts to increase the talent level within S&T and technology and everything like that, how do you prevent the nation's next level, like next top group of talent, from joining like Silicon Valley firms or going into private sector? How do you get them to say, hey, don't take that systems engineer job at Google and do this work for the Army?
What we offer is a different line of work, a more exciting line of work. I got to offer them also the opportunity to serve their country, to serve a greater good, to help protect the nation. So that's what we offer in those regards. I can never compete with the private sector when it comes to salaries and things like that, but we offer a different thing, and not everybody's coin-operated. Some people aspire to do things for, the good of the country or for the nation's defense. So we got to appeal to that part of each individual or to those individuals who might be interested.
Here in the third row, and then we'll start to wrap up.
Thank you. I'm Satoshi Nishida from the Liberty Magazine and Happy Science Group in Japan. About foreign policy, North Korean issue is the biggest one for Japanese people. And Prime Minister Abe has been concerned about being a little bit sidelined as deal maker, and that's why he's coming to Washington, D.C. the day after tomorrow. And I have been wondering what would be the major role, Army's major role regarding North Korea, and what would you think is the ideal scenario for the meeting on June 12th? Thank you.
Well, I won't comment on the meeting or those types of issues, but I will say that our responsibility is to make sure wherever Army forces are deployed in the world that we are ready and able to meet the nation's goals, to answer the commander-in-chief's call, and be prepared to fight and win.
Gentleman here in the sixth row. And then we'll do one more after that and call it a day.
Sure. Byron Callen, Capital Alpha Partners. I wonder if you can talk a bit about urban warfare and how that affects how you think about equipping the force in this five-year time period over a 10-year time period. It's a very different set of problems, as you're aware, than fighting in a desert or even in Germany. So
yeah.
What kind of requirements do you think will come out of that? What should industry be thinking about how they can help the Army with this problem?
Sure. It's a very good question. I call it out in our vision statement and certainly in the details of the papers that will follow. And because we see more and more people are moving to cities, we see the growth of cities, we know that the likelihood is we will be fighting more in populated areas than in rolling plains of Europe like we used to consider. So it does present challenges. You need to make sure that you have vehicles that can operate in narrow streets, that can elevate guns, that are protected from the top. So there are a number of things like that that, as we think through that, we need to make sure we build into our future weapon systems just for that purpose, so that we are maximized for that type of fight.
And finally, here in the fourth row, I think that'll be it.
Chris Nomari, Center Grove High School in Indianapolis. Under the auspices of the NDS, how is the Army working to assist any of our Baltic NATO allies as they counteract Russian aggression?
Are you sure you're from high school? Well, you know, the Army deploys on nine-month deployments now to Europe as part of Atlantic Resolve, and so we are heading to Germany and Poland. I was over there this January and February to visit our troops, spent a good amount of time. We have NATO partners throughout the Baltics who are working with our allies there. And so I think, you know, our presence there has two missions. One is to reassure our allies, and secondly, to deter any type of bad behavior. So we think about that. I had a chance to sit down and spend some time with General Scaparotti to talk about the challenges he faces, to make sure that where the Army sits now and where we're focused on is in the right direction. So we look at that very closely. That regional role that Russia as a strategic competitor is called out by the National Defense Strategy. So that's one of the areas where we're focused on.
And before I ask folks to thank you and wish you well and join me in, you know, the appreciation for your visit today, let me just add one last follow-up on that same general issue. I've heard over in recent years General Milley and others express concern about the operational tempo of the Army, mm-hmm. and partly because the deployments in Eastern Europe and Korea and Afghanistan and Iraq of a different type and elsewhere have, even though they each individually look relatively small, they require a large base underneath them with the rotation policies that you've used for each of those locations. Is it time that, partly just as a force management issue, we consider stationing forces in Eastern Europe, not in large numbers perhaps, but in order to let a given unit stay there and not require one to prepare, one to be there, one to recover, and just make it a little bit easier on the Army? Or do you think we're getting to a more sustainable place in terms of Army operational tempo, acknowledging we don't know what the future holds, but that we don't really need that kind of a measure, at least from the point of view of force management?
I don't think the tempo right now is at a sustainable pace. I think we need to lower it some. That will give us the ability to spend more time at home station. It helps the soldiers with regard to preparing for the next fight. It helps the families. It helps us reset the equipment. It helps us train for that next fight. So I think we need to look at the pace. And I would never take anything off the table with regard to forward positioning, but the model we have right now is the ability to project forces from the United States anywhere in the world to make sure we can be there as quickly as possible. So that's why the mission statement calls for not just fighting winning, but deploying fighting and winning is critical. But I think we have to continue to look at those things. We hear from the combatant commanders. Again, that's more outside my lane. But it does impact the Army. My responsibility is because of the op tempo impacts and what it means.
Right. Everybody, please join me in thanking Secretary Esper.